From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, on the trail of lost pets, we talk with Kat Albrecht, former canine cop who now trains and uses dogs to search for lost dogs, cats, ferrets, snakes, and turtles. We'll talk about how lost pets behave and how search dogs can track them. Albrecht has written a new book called The Lost Pet Chronicles. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Bone Woman, a memoir by forensic anthropologist Clea Koff. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Now Here Is Nowhere, the first major label release by the trio Secret Machines. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Just an hour from now, President Bush will deliver a speech designed to reassure the public about his Iraq policy. White House spokesman Scott McClellan says the president will outline his plan to restore peace and stability to Iraq.
The president will update the American people about the clear strategy for the way forward to a free, democratic, and peaceful Iraq.
According to excerpts released by the White House, the president will also say that history will tend toward hope or tragedy in Iraq. He'll also promise to build a modern maximum security prison in Iraq and demolish the Abu Ghraib prison, the site of torture and killing by Saddam Hussein's regime, and more recently of torture and abuse of Iraqi prisoners by U.S. troops. As the U.S. and Britain presented a new Iraq resolution to the United Nations Security Council, U.N. envoy Lakhdar Brahimi tried to forge a consensus on an interim Iraqi government. The U.S. occupation authority is due to hand over power June 30th. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Baghdad.
As an explosion killed two British security guards just outside the main gate of the U.S. authority compound in Baghdad, Mr. Brahimi met inside with dozens of Iraqis whose parties are jostling for position in the new government. A leading Kurdish politician, Adil Murad, said after 80 years of being treated as second-class citizens, Kurds would only accept the presidency or prime ministership in an interim government, not a vice presidency or deputy slot.
We don't like vice president, vice prime minister, vice. We don't like this war.
Shiite parties are also vying for the prime minister's job, as are other Iraqis. A Sunni, Adnan Pachachi, is still seen as a leading candidate for interim president. Brahimi hopes to have a plan in place by the end of May, but that may slip by a few days. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Baghdad.
Israel has declared an end to its operation in the southern Gaza Strip, lifting the siege in parts of Rafah and pulling back tanks and troops from the area adjacent to the Egyptian border. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
7 days after it began, the Israeli incursion drew to a close with troops completing their pullout. The division commander said the forces killed what he called 41 terrorists and demolished 56 Palestinian homes during the operation that the army says was aimed at destroying tunnels used by Palestinians to smuggle weapons from the Egyptian side of the border. Palestinians say children and innocent bystanders were among those killed. Burials were held throughout Rafah Monday as troops pulled out and mourners held funerals. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon lobbied cabinet members on a revamped gradual withdrawal of settlers and soldiers from the Gaza Strip. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Dow lost 8 to close at 99.58. This is NPR News. People in Halem, Nebraska are salvaging their belongings today. A swarm of tornadoes devastated the small town Saturday night. Fred Knapp reports from Nebraska Public Radio.
In the middle of denuded, snapped-off trees and piles of 2x4s that once were houses, Becky Sherman opens the glass on the red brick sign of the Congregational United Church of Christ. In it, she places a hand-lettered cardboard sign reading, "God Bless Halem." And even as construction equipment clears away the rubble of the church, Sherman declares her faith unshaken.
I think some things are out of God's control, but He's here to help get us through it and surround us with support and love. And I think we're going to pull through. Halem survived a fire years ago, and he'll survive this.
One woman died, and nearly every home was destroyed or damaged in this southeast Nebraska town of 276 people. For NPR News, I'm Fred Knapp in Lincoln, Nebraska.
A federal court has thrown out the government's case against an Oregon lawyer who was erroneously connected to the Madrid train bombings. Federal authorities arrested Brandon Mayfield earlier this month, saying that his fingerprint had been found in Madrid on a plastic bag containing detonators. Spanish officials later found that the fingerprint actually belonged to an Algerian man. Although Mayfield was released, federal authorities continued to call him a material witness and to restrict his movements. Mayfield is a convert to Islam who once represented a man who pleaded guilty to a charge of attempting to help the Taliban fight the U.S. in Afghanistan. In stocks, the Nasdaq gained 11 points today to close at 1922. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence, online at TRoePrice.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kat Albrecht, is a pet detective who has written a new memoir called The Lost Pet Chronicles. She estimates that she's helped over 1,800 pet owners locate their lost dogs, cats, snakes, turtles, ferrets, iguanas, and horses. Earlier in her career, she worked as a police officer and detective. She handled bloodhounds on search and rescue missions. The first time she searched for a missing pet, it was her own bloodhound, AJ, who had disappeared after he dug out of his kennel. She called a friend who had a golden retriever. The retriever found AJ in 20 minutes. Albrecht told me how the golden retriever found the bloodhound.
My friend's dog, Kea, we scented her on AJ's bedding, and she's trained in scent discrimination, meaning she understood smell this toothbrush or smell this pillowcase and find this person and ignore all other human scent out there. When we scented her, we didn't know whether she would understand smell AJ's bedding and find AJ, but we knew that she and AJ loved each other. They often played together, and so it was the only hope I had of being able to know which direction he went, because he could have been anywhere out in the woods. She picked up the scent trail, and we worked behind her, and within about 20 minutes, she led us up to a cabin where we saw AJ up sniffing around at some boxes on a porch, and we were able to retrieve him and bring him home.
Was he happy to see you?
Yes, he was happy to see me. I was a little angry at him, but I had never felt that raw panic before in my life. Now, as a police officer, I had for several years had worked many, devastating emergencies, homicides, sexual assault cases where I'd seen people at their worst. But I had never experienced my worst until the day that AJ was missing. For that hour of my life, I was devastated.
Now, you were able to have a dog track AJ scent and find AJ, but you say that most search dogs are actually useless for finding other pets because they're trained to ignore the scent of animals. Why?
Most search and rescue dog handlers spend much of their time discouraging or disciplining their dogs if they get off on animal scent. That's because it's critical that when you're working a law enforcement case that your dog is focused on finding the human scent, and that it is trained to ignore dogs, cats, and other critter scent. So it's definitely not something that you can call up the average search and rescue dog handler and ask them to come and track your pets. So I knew this when I ventured into this territory, and I knew that once that I made the transition with my police dogs that I could not go back and use them on law enforcement cases again. So it was a tough decision.
Was it hard to retrain them to search for animals?
You know, no, it was actually quite easy because they had always, particularly Rachel, had loved kitties. And in fact, I would be directing her to search for a gun or evidence, and she would lope off on a bunny hunt, and I'd be yelling at her to go find the gun or to search for the physical evidence. And so we always had these little tiffs about what I wanted her to find and what she wanted to find. So the first day that I presented a tuft of fur under her nose and told her, take scent, find the kitty, she just looked up at me like, yes, finally you understand what I've wanted to hunt all along. So I found it quite simple. And also with the bloodhounds, my two bloodhounds too, once I scented them, they just would take off and just love to track the animal scent.
Now, you know, I always assume that a lot of animals don't really like other animals. A lot of cats are loners, and they don't care for other cats or dogs. A lot of dogs don't get along with other dogs or other cats. So do you need a particularly gregarious search dog to do this kind of work?
Yes, actually, I now have several dogs in training, and I'm launching seminars on how to train your dog to find lost pets. And what I look for in the dogs that I train to find cats are dogs that love kitties. So we put them through a testing process, an evaluation, and they have to show the behavior that they want to be with a cat. They're not going to chase and harm a cat because this is search and rescue, not search and destroy. And the dogs that we train to track the scent trail of lost dogs are the dog park dog mentality, the dogs that want nothing more than to play with another dog. And if they don't exhibit either of those behaviors, then they just don't pass evaluation, and we don't. I don't spend the time training them.
Is it easier for a search dog to trace the scent of a an animal than a person? What I'm thinking is that, like dogs particularly, your average dog is probably a little smellier than your average person, although your average person can be pretty stinky if, on certain occasions. But, you know, just kind of like generalizing, are dogs smellier and easier to find?
You know, that's a good question, but I don't know. And I don't, I've just noticed that the dogs have been able to be successful at both. And so I haven't been able to tell. And obviously they're not talking. But what I do know is that it really depends on the motivation of the dog. And if you have a dog that loves people, like my search dogs have, and they love to eat cheese, and they know that the person hiding at the end of that scent trail is going to give them a piece of cheese and going to pet them, they will do anything they can to follow that scent trail to find them. That's the basis of the training. With the dogs that we train to find missing dogs, their reward at the end of the trail, after they sniff the bedding from the dog that we have hidden out there, their reward is that they get to play with that other dog. So they have such a high play drive that when they get there, they're rewarded, and they just work. They use their noses and they just get there.
Yeah. What if the dog on the other end doesn't really want to play? What if that dog wants to attack?
Well, during training, what we do is the only dogs that we hide out there, that we lay a trail, as we call it, they're laying a scent trail as they're walking along, and we call those target dogs. They are dogs that love to play with other dogs, so they're always rewarded with that play at the end. On actual searches, oftentimes we never make it right up to the dog. In a typical lost dog case, we establish the direction of travel, and that enables the owner to be able to place the lost dog posters and interview witnesses in the neighborhood and get a positive sighting and recovery of their dog.
So how do you reinforce the reward if there's no dog to play with at the end of the trail?
Well, when they work an actual case, just like in actual search and rescue, it's different from training. So the dogs do get accustomed to the fact that there is no closure for them, or they won't make a find at the end. Initially, in training a search and rescue dog, there's always going to be the person hidden there that they're going to find and be rewarded. But they become accustomed to working, trails that are actual scent trails where they don't actually track up and find the person, and they become used to that.
So working dogs, they're just they know life isn't just fun. I mean, they know they've got a job to do.
I'm not sure. I know that my dogs, when I would prepare to go on a search, they would see me picking up my search pack and the harness, and they would get just totally ecstatic because, you know, I think in their mind they thought, cheese, because they're probably thinking we're going to train and someone's going to hide at the end with a piece of cheese. Of course, I always gave them cheese when we completed the trail, or, you know, either worked a missing person or a criminal case and didn't walk up and find the person, but got to a point where the scent ended and we believe the suspect got into a vehicle, then I would always give them the cheese reward and put them in their crate, and, you know, they would be happy.
You have two bloodhounds now. What makes bloodhounds so good at following scents?
Well, bloodhounds were bred to hunt animals centuries ago, but they, in particular, they were used to hunt people. And they're known as manhunters. They just have an instinctive drive to use their nose to work a colder, what's called colder, older scent, meaning they can track a scent trail after it's been out there several days. Their bodies are built for hunting. They have jowls that causes them to slobber, and that moisture will collect the scent. Their long, dangly ears will ruffle scent particles that may be dormant on the ground and enable them to enter the nasal cavity, and they can process it. They're just hunting machines. Other dogs can be and are trained to do what bloodhounds can do, but what sets them apart, in particular in law enforcement cases, is that their testimony is acceptable in a court of law when it comes to criminal prosecutions. What a bloodhound does on a case, if it meets certain requirements that the courts have set up, is acceptable testimony.
In addition to working with bloodhounds, you work with Weimaraners. How would you compare bloodhounds and Weimaraners when it comes to tracking scent?
Well, Weimaraners are actually a bird dog, so they're actually more of an air-scenting breed. They're bred to use their nose to detect airborne scent particles and to freeze in point when they find a bird. So the fact that I took one and trained it as a cadaver evidence dog was a little unusual, but really you can train any breed of dog to do cadaver evidence work as long as it has the right drive and interest and trainability. As far as following or tracking a scent trail, obviously that's what I had spent 100% of my time using my hounds for, and they were very good at it. Rachel, my Weimaraner that I had trained, it was easy for me to shift and use her to detect the airborne scent of cats as opposed to trying to use her to track the scent trail, although I had several successful cases where she did track the scent trail. So I did cross-train her for both. If she picked up the airborne scent particle of a human, she would act differently. She would throw her nose up high in the air, and her tail would lift about 3/4 of an inch, and I could tell that she was scenting on a human. She just looked different and behaved differently when she picked up the scent of a live human versus a live cat. So they were both effective, but just very different.
My guest is Kat Albrecht. She's written a new memoir called The Lost Pet Chronicles. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kat Albrecht, and she's a pet detective. She has trained dogs who search out lost animals, and they're trained to find the scent of lost pets. And she's a former police officer. I'm sure you've witnessed a fair number of pet reunions between people and their lost pets. You know, a dog will kind of run to see you and jump all over you when the dog is happy to see you, but cats show their affection in a less obvious way sometimes. The cat will come to the door and fuss to be petted, but they're not gonna. They're just different from dogs. Well, what are some of the cat person reunions been like? Do the cats rush over to meet the people after they've been found?
No, actually, most of the cats have been hiding in fear. Mm-hmm. And therefore, their owners, one of the primary tools that they've used to recover their cat has been a baited humane trap, which is a tool that's used right now by feral cat groups to recover unwanted wild cats. And it's one that we advocate using as a recovery tool for a missing cat. And many of those owners are holding a panicked cat that's scratching and trying to get away from them, because a cat is so traumatized by the experience of having escaped outside. But those reunions, I'm looking at and what I really see is the joy in the owner and just the, thank you so much. I can't believe I have my cat back. Primarily what we hear is, I can't believe he was this close all along. I called him for 3 days. He never meowed, and he was right here all along.
Right where, usually?
Usually the cats that we are finding that are displaced, meaning they're indoor-only cats that push out a window or escape out a door, are either hiding under the owner's own home, under their deck, or in a neighbor on either side of them. They exhibit what we call the silence factor, meaning they do not meow. And they will stay there. Some of the cats, depending on the temperament, if it's a skittish, shy cat that has neophobias, meaning it was from kittenhood experiences and genetics, it is just ingrained that this cat will hide under the bed even when a stranger comes in the house. Those cats can remain outside for 6 to 8 weeks without making a sound. And the owner, if they do not understand that the cat is nearby, they will give up searching and that cat will be absorbed into the feral cat population.
So do you think the cats usually recognize their people when they are reunited?
I think that the cats recognize their owners, but their instincts take over in a way that you don't see with dogs. Dogs, of course, there's the happy licking, excited whining, I'm so happy to be home. Whereas with the cats, their instincts are to protect themselves from predators, and they even see their owners as being a potential predator. That's why they hide and they don't meow, and they can be 3 feet from the owner's front door for 3 days, and the owner thinks, you know, that their cat ran away from home. Cats, they're just a different animal than dogs. And, you know, I'm learning that myself with the cats that I have now. They don't. I try to treat them like dogs and try to hug and kiss them, and they do not appreciate it as much as I would like them to.
Since cats see dogs as predators, if a dog is sniffing for a cat, trying to find the lost animal, might the cat just run away, thinking that the dog is a predator to be avoided?
That's a real valid point, and that's one reason why when we go out and search for a cat using the cat detection dog, we keep the dog tethered on a harness. And basically what the dog is trained to do is wherever the handler points for the dog to sniff, whether that's at the vent of at the base of a house by a screen vent or under a deck or in heavy bushes, that the dog is just trained to not go in after the cat, but to sniff. And if it detects the scent of the cat, it will let the handler know.
You've described a little bit some of the cat patterns when a cat slips out the window or door and runs away from home. What about dogs? Are there any typical patterns of dogs who are lost?
With dogs, it's different because dogs travel. Cats are territorial. Their instinct when they are sick or injured or afraid is they will hide and they will not meow. The first thing they do is look for some place to hide, and they make that their new territory. With dogs, they will move if they are frightened, such as by fireworks. They will move at a rapid speed, and they will run blindly, and they're at risk of being hit by cars. But they oftentimes will run until they get to a point where they can hide somewhere, like in a garage or behind somebody's wood pile in a yard. But the distance that a dog will travel or will be found from their escape point varies. It depends on several factors, and some of those have to do with human behavior. You can have a skittish, shy, mixed breed dog, a pit bull mix, trotting down the road, and people will not pull over to try to rescue that dog. But if you have a Irish setter or Old English sheepdog or purebred French bulldog that's trotting down the road, people will be more likely to pull over because they will think lost dog or valuable pet or something of value that they want to keep themselves. And so they're more likely to intervene if it's a purebred, highly recognizable dog. So that's just one example of the human behavior. And if you have a dog that is skittish and shy and will growl at somebody when they try to approach it, that dog is going to travel farther than will a wiggly butt golden retriever that, you know, will run up to the first person that that talks to it.
You have chosen your dogs from litters, and you had to decide from among the very cute pups in those litters. What are the traits you look for when you're choosing a dog to put to work as a search dog?
You know, I've Yes, it's true that when I was a police officer and picking the dogs for my own use, I did pick them as puppies. But I'm shifting away from that mode because what I know in the training of dogs to do this work of finding missing pets, that there are so many dogs at the animal shelters that we can train to do this work. One of the dogs that I have right now was heading to doggy death row. Her name is Cody, and she's a Whippet mutt mix. She was heading to the animal shelter because she digs, she jumps, she chews, but she loves people, loves dogs, and loves kitties. And she is right now stolen my heart and is just a fabulous cat detection dog. She is going to find a lot of missing cats. And I know that there are many Codys that are out there at the animal shelters right now that we, our nonprofit Missing Pet Partnership, plans to go and evaluate these dogs, pull them from the shelters, train them to look for missing pets, and donate them to animal shelters and animal rescue groups across the country that we plan to partner with and train to go and do the same services that you read about in my book.
Now, I would have thought it would be too late to train an adult dog to follow scent.
No, absolutely not. If you start with a young puppy, you can start training the puppy at a very young age. But absolutely not. Dogs. We have dogs in the training program that are 4 or 6 years old. The problem with taking an older dog is sometimes it depends on the training that you do. If you choose to do the scent discrimination training, it can take up over a year, sometimes 2 years of intensive training before the dog is search ready. And then by that time, you know, the amount of years that you have left with the dog, are limited. So a year is a good age to start with for training a search dog. But you can start with a puppy. But our preference is that we will evaluate dogs that are at least a year old.
Kat Albrecht's new book is called The Lost Pet Chronicles. She's the founder of Missing Pet Partnership. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble. Now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. By TIAA CREF, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org. And from Knopf, publisher of Eventide, the new novel by Kent Harif, author of Plainsong. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, training a cat to help train search dogs. We continue our conversation with pet detective Kat Albrecht. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews The Bone Woman, a memoir by forensic anthropologist Clea Koff, and Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the trio Secret Machines. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kat Albrecht. She's a former police officer and detective who worked handling bloodhounds on search and rescue missions. Now she's a pet detective who uses search dogs to find lost pets large and small, from dogs and cats to horses and turtles. She's written a new memoir called The Lost Pet Chronicles. You train dogs, but you've also had to work with cats because you have at least one cat that you've used as the target cat. In other words, you train the cat to just kind of act as if it's lost so that then you can teach the dog how to find the lost cat. Are cats hard to train even to do something simple like staying still and acting lost?
Oh, cats are great. And, you know, before I started training my dogs to find missing cats, I had always pretty much owned a cat, but I was not hooked in as a cat lover until my first experience with getting a great cat, and that was with Myron. And when I got Myron and started training him, I had to harness train him to walk on a harness and leash so he could lay a scent trail. And I write about this in the book, how I had gone into the veterinarian and took Myron in there and told the vet tech how I was harness training Myron. Well, she thought that by harness, you know, that the bloodhounds wear a harness. And she looked at Myron and looked at me and looked back at Myron and said, "You mean you're training your cat to track lost dogs?" And so it was pretty amusing. But the other cats that we use now, including this obnoxious orange cat named Cheeto, are kitties that love dogs. Myron and Cheeto... they're so accustomed to my dogs, and every morning when I let Cody out, she'll find and lick them and play with them and get all excited about, you know, washing the kitty's face, and the cat's just kind of like, yeah, whatever. But these cats have a gregarious temperament. They're ones that crate well. I've trained them by placing them in a crate and setting them outside and putting bread and bird seed down. They could sit. They learn to lay quietly in these crates because their reward is they get to lay and watch birdies come and eat, and so they don't become fussy or upset while being in the crate. So when we go to the trainings, we take these cats in the crate and we will hide them in some heavy brush, and we have the cat detection dogs. We take them one at a time and have them search around. And when they find the kitty, they are trained that they will give the physical alert. Typically, they're wiggling and wagging their tails. They will run back to the handler, jump on the handler, go back to the kitty, and then we open the crate up, and the kitty is let out, and they're on a harness and lead, and then the dog gets to play with the kitty. And the cats are so used to it, they love it. They'll, you know, they look forward to the training dates. They run into the crate when they see me pull it out.
Now, in addition to searching for cats and dogs, you've searched for more unusual pets, or at least smaller pets, from snakes to turtles and geckos, iguanas, ferrets. Are they any more difficult to search for than cats and dogs?
Well, yeah, because I don't have as much knowledge and experience with these different animals than I do with cats and dogs. I mean, with cats and dogs, just like with humans, you can predict behavior. That's one thing that I have been experimenting with, is developing a system of profiling lost pet behavior. You can have a berry picker, a backpacker, and a hunter that can be lost in the same area of the woods, but the strategy, the techniques, the tactics that you use for these three categories are entirely different. And so one thing that I've identified is the strategies, the techniques, and the tactics that you use to look for a lost dog are entirely different than how you look for a indoor cat that has escaped outside. And that's entirely different than how you would search for an outdoor access cat that vanishes. And that's different than how you would look for a box turtle that vanishes. So understanding the behavior of the animals and how those will dictate the distances that these animals travel and how soon people will intervene. It's a science, and it's something that I'm working to develop, but it's a struggle.
You used to work with dogs for the police, and you used your search dogs to help find lost people, clues, dead people. In your experience, did the police have a lot of faith in search dogs? The police that you worked with, yeah.
It depended on the agency and on the individual investigator that you know, that had called me out. You know, initially, the one of the first police departments I worked for had no faith in bloodhounds. In fact, after spending 18 months there, they basically said that bloodhounds will never be used here. If you want to work your dog, you need to go elsewhere. And so I did. And I landed with a department that was supportive and in an area of California that had previously used bloodhounds with great success and other search and rescue dogs. So I found it much easier when I went over, when I left Fresno County and went over to Santa Cruz County. It was much easier for the agencies to call me out with my dogs. One of the first searches that I used my cadaver dog on was the polyclass search. And that case then opened the door a couple months later for Rachel to work a homicide case where the detective really was skeptical. He really had never seen a cadaver dog work before. And in his experience with the police patrol dogs that he had seen, he had not had much faith in dogs. But when Rachel went out there and was finding the evidence that was right out there, but it just wasn't visible, he was impressed.
How did your dog do in trying to track down polyclass?
Well, in the polyclass case, we were deployed in the area off Pythian Road, which, you know, was the area where Richard Allen Davis had his car was stranded, and then several months later, the owner of the property had found physical evidence and had pretty much made the connection that the person that she had seen months earlier could likely be Richard Allen Davis. So we were in an area that had already been searched, that the FBI had was just Polly hadn't been found yet. So they were wondering if her, if, you know, he had disposed of her body in this particular area. And by the time that we finished the search that evening, Richard Allen Davis confessed and then told them where he had placed her body, which was actually north of our location up in Cloverdale. So we weren't even in the area where her body was. Rachel did great. I mean, she searched with the team that I was with, and we did a great job. But you know, as in any case, when you're searching for something, if you're searching in an area where the evidence, you know, whether that be physical evidence or a person or a pet, if you're searching and they're not there, then you're not going to find them. And, you know, whether you call that a success or not, I'm not sure. I'm often asked about, you know, our success rate, and there's just many cases where we search for a missing pet and we didn't find it, but we have no way of knowing if the cat or the dog was, you know, even still in the area or not.
What advice would you have for people who have lost a cat or a dog? Do those posters on the trees or in the convenience stores help?
Well, the posters help primarily with lost dogs because typically the dog is out there, it's traveling, and somebody's going to pick it up. Invariably, a lost dog is going to end up with somebody who finds it, and they either self-rescue it or they turn it into a rescue group or they turn it over to a friend. Sometimes they take it to the animal shelter. But don't count on it. You still want to search the shelter every day if possible for your dog or cat when it's missing. But really your focus with a lost dog is getting the word out there that your dog is missing and really focusing on getting the word out to a lot of rescue groups, because oftentimes many of the missing pets end up or missing dogs end up there and are never taken to the shelter. The one place where the dog owner is searching is often the last place that anyone will take it because of the fear that it will be put to sleep. With missing cats, cats will be close. Some cats are transported out of the area, but if it's a displaced, fearful cat, it's going to be nearby and hiding, and using a baited humane trap as a recovery tool is a primary way to get the cat back. We have a website that I would recommend that if you've lost a pet that you check. It's www.lostapet.org.
You operate as a nonprofit. Why?
Yes. We operate as a nonprofit organization, and I founded Missing Pet Partnership because I want to see lost pet services developed on a national level, and I want them to be around for years to come. I, at one point, was a sole proprietor and a pet detective that was paid for my services. But I asked the question, why hasn't anybody else trained a dog to do this? And someone told me that there had been a man in Texas who had trained his bloodhound to track lost pets. And when I asked what happened to him, they said that he died back in 1984. And I realized, well, what happens when I die? These services would die with me. And so it helped to broaden my vision for pioneering this service through a nonprofit so that this can be available for pet owners maybe 5 or 10 years from now.
Now, your name is Kat, K-A-T, which is short for Catherine or Kathy.
Kathy.
Are you intentionally using like a pussycat kind of cat there? I mean, do you intend for it to have animal-like insinuations? Yeah.
My nickname, Kat, actually came from the seventh grade when my best friend's name was Kathy, and we just became Kat and Kat. And I never knew that I was going to be a pet detective. I just grew up being Kat. So I have had to suffer through the fact that my name, you know, that I'm a pet detective with the name of Kat, and teased for it ruthlessly. But no, it has nothing to do with the work that I do. It's just a freak of nature, I guess.
So did you have a lot of pets as a kid?
I always grew up with a family dog. I didn't have my first cat until after my dad had passed away. He did not like cats. So I always grew up with dogs and grew up with a love and fascination after reading books like Old Yeller and Where the Red Fern Grows. Grew up with a love of hunting dogs. So that's really where my basis and love for training dogs came in was reading as a child.
What do you do with your search dogs when they're ready to retire? How do they take to retirement?
Well, AJ is retired, and, you know, they just still live
there. Do they play golf?
No, he just lays. He just sleeps a lot and watches a lot of TV. You know, they just they're just not working anymore, and they get used to seeing me take off with the other dogs. So, you know, it's hard. AJ is 12 now, which is really old for a bloodhound. Mm-hmm. He's deaf. He's gray. His body has really changed a lot. And, you know, I'm not sure how much longer he'll be around. But, you know, he was a wonderful search dog. And, you know, he's a hero. And, you know, so he deserves to rest and play golf and watch TV the rest of his life.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work and your animals.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Kat Albrecht's new book is called The Lost Pet Chronicles. She's the founder of Missing Pet Partnership. Their website is lostapet.org. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews The Bone Woman, a new memoir by forensic anthropologist Clea Koff. This is Fresh Air. In 1996, Clea Koff was a 23-year-old graduate student studying prehistoric skeletons in Berkeley, California. Then she was sent by the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda to the site of a mass grave to help exhume bodies and strengthen the UN's case against alleged perpetrators of genocide. As a forensic anthropologist working for the UN, Koff spent the next few years investigating other mass graves in Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo. She describes her work in her new book, The Bone Woman. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
A few weeks after September 11th, 2001, Leon Wieseltier, literary editor of The New Republic, wrote a column that should be required reading for any aspiring or practicing writers. Wieseltier went after what he saw as excessively fine literary accounts of September 11th. For instance, he quoted from a piece published by John Updike in The New Yorker, in which Updike described the destruction of the Twin Towers thusly: "Smoke speckled with bits of paper curled into the cloudless sky, and strange inky rivulets ran down the giant structure's vertically corrugated surface." Such writing, Weasel Tear rightly commented, defeats its representational purpose because it steals attention away from reality and toward language. It is provoked by nothing so much as its own delicacy. I thought a lot about Weasel Tear's denunciation of pretty adjectives and adverbs as a kind of linguistic armor against atrocity as I was reading Clea Kaff's book, The Bone Woman. Kaff is a forensic anthropologist, and she writes with a restraint and eye for detail that you would expect of a scientist. Perhaps because of that training, Kaff avoids straining for big meditations on life and death in her book. As a forensic anthropologist, Kaff knows that bones talk, and she simply lets the bones she exhumes give testimony here. In descriptions free of sensationalism or sentimentality, Kaff recounts unearthing skeletons and partially decomposed corpses of the victims of genocide around the world. Standing sometimes waist-deep in groundwater, Kaff and other members of her UN team exhumed human remains thrown into mass graves in rubbish pits and mines and latrine holes. Maggots and stench and all the horrors that flesh is heir to were part of Kaff's everyday working conditions, a work she could only do, she says, by maintaining her anthropological stance of seeing remains as a puzzle that she needed to solve. It's that same emotional distance that gives the bone woman its pared-down power. Kaff concedes that her odd profession grew out of being an odd child, the daughter of a Tanzanian mother and a white American father, both documentary filmmakers. She grew up around the world. From the time she was 7, Kaff says, she was collecting dead birds and burying them. By 13, she was burying other dead birds in plastic bags and digging them up later to see how long it would take them to turn into skeletons. Kaff's weird hobbies were focused into a career after she was inspired by a book called Witnesses from the Grave about a group of graduate students led by forensic anthropologist Clyde Snow, who unearthed and tried to identify the remains of Argentines who disappeared during the military junta of the 1970s and 80s. Kaff begins her account of each mission with a summary of the political conflict that sparked these crimes against humanity in the first place. Then she details how she and her team assembled the physical evidence necessary to prove genocide. In Bosnia in 1996, for instance, Kaff recounts how she and other UN workers dodged landmines as they exhumed the bodies of some 150 men and boys. Surviving female family members had been told by officials that their vanished menfolk had just run off. When the women were persuaded to come look at the bodies, they identified their missing sons and husbands by the individual sewing stitches they used to repair the worn-out clothing found on the corpses. Earlier that same year in Rwanda, Kaff and her team worked outside a rural church on the shores of Lake Kivu. It's an Edenic spot where, in 1994, several thousand people seeking refuge were slaughtered over a period of days by grenades and machetes wielded by militiamen. Kaff and her co-workers eventually exhumed over 500 bodies from a single mass grave, one section of which they began calling the nursery because the remains of so many children were found there. Why does anyone, even a scientist, choose to witness such horrors over and over? Kaff admits to anxiety attacks and to being haunted by nightmares of lying in bed with body parts. But she also says a dead body can incriminate perpetrators who believe they have silenced their victims forever. This is the part of forensic anthropology that drives me, this kicking a bad guy ass when it's least expected. The Bone Woman deals with gruesome subjects, but it is not itself a gruesome book. Through its unpoetic vision of all those piles and piles of exhumed bones, Kaff's book testifies to our humbling common humanity that the perpetrators of genocide would deny.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Bone Woman by Clea Kaff. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the first major label release by the trio Secret Machines. This is Fresh Air. The trio called Secret Machines originated in Dallas, Texas. They've relocated to Brooklyn, New York, and have just put out their first major label release called Now Here Is Nowhere. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the band constructs long, complex songs whose structures build to satisfyingly distinctive climaxes.
Secret Machines consists of brothers Ben and Brandon Curtis on guitar and bass, and drummer Josh Garza. Brandon says the music he's most been influenced by was made between the years 1967 and 72. You can tell just from listening to the audacious, just under 9 minutes track that leads off the album, that this means he and his brother are into the discursive, trippy sounds of everyone from Pink Floyd and Can to the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead. They layer their guitar and bass lines on top of each other as though they're building houses of sound. And then Garza's drums come along to give the edifice a good rattling shake.
Did you get your heartache and your head rush confused? Had you been sleeping late because you'd been abused? Are you alone? Does it feel like those around?
I hear Texas as much as New York in Secret Machines' work. When they're not building songs vertically, finishing each verse like another story on an apartment house, they're working horizontally, making the music equivalent of vast, wide-open spaces, across which drift soft voices and choruses that swirl and double back on each other like tumbleweeds, or in this song, wind-blown leaves. Although they cite psychedelia as a musical touchstone, Secret Machines is very much a band for this time, in the sense that there's very little countercultural open-heartedness or empty-headedness in their work. Their serpentine melodies don't just slither off aimlessly or dribble away in stone bemusement. These guys work hard and don't want you to miss that fact. This approach can lead to a certain cold rigor that's not always particularly appealing. But it can also lead to wonderfully focused jams like this one called Nowhere Again.
Cellophane flowers never happened for me. Been sleeping the day off, watching the night fall, covering nowhere, filling my timeshare. There's a woman in the mirror in a fiery state as she motions to me to start turning away. She's lifting her dress up.
I don't have too much interest in trying to follow Secret Machines' determinedly abstruse lyrics. After decoding a few closely, I don't find the sentiments particularly original or their wordplay artful in any way. The sound of their voices is, as often as not, a nattering moan that works better as noise than verbal communication. And sometimes, on a song like Pharaoh's Daughter, they come all too close to achieving the sort of tremulous kitsch that made Pink Floyd such airy twits. I can't play a number of their best songs, like You Are Chains, because the music doesn't lend itself to being cut into snippets. Lots of times their finest effects kick in 2 or 3 minutes into a song. And waiting for that kick is half the, well, not exactly fun, but a reward. A reward for following secret machines down their secret paths to a fresh beginning.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the new CD by Secret Machines called Now Here Is Nowhere. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Endless Pools, a treadmill for swimmers, allowing people to swim at home year-round, indoors or outside. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS. That's 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with critic John Powers, who is just back from the Cannes Film Festival, where Michael Moore's documentary Fahrenheit 9/11 won the top prize. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.